this out right here, right now. Chapter 27. Oh, come on, Cash snorted, rising to his full height. Don't be ridiculous. Harry, Snail put a hand on my arm, this isn't a good idea. Victoria, our special agent friend here thinks in very simple terms. I kept my eyes on Cash. He's not a complex man. He understands strength and weakness, good and evil, winning and losing. He needs to be shown that he isn't the alpha dog here, and when he knows that, he can fall the fuck into line. Already I could see Cash's interest in my challenge peaking, the way it had the night before when I ragged on his workout. A smile was playing about the corners of his mouth. I don't hit women, Cash sneered. So you can back down right now before you overexert yourself. You don't have to hit me. You just have to pin me. And what exactly will that achieve? He asked. Whoever gets their face pinned against the dirt loses all jurisdictional authority over this investigation. Ah, bullshit, Cash snorted. I'm SAS combat trained, sweetheart. Then this should be over quickly. I'm not involved in this. Snail backed off towards the truck, her head down. I need you as a witness, I called. So what? I pin you against the dirt and I'm the boss. Cash's eyes wandered over my body, measuring, underestimating, the way everybody did. And you'll fully accept that? It's my investigation to run from start to finish. It's gotta be the face. Right, Cash said. I put your face in the dirt and your ass is mine. You put my face in that dirt and I will trawl this town for Islamic terrorists until the cows come home. I put my hand on my heart. I will speak operational jargon so pompous and ridiculously over-official that not even you will be able to understand me. He didn't even ask me what I wanted him to do if I won. The possibility never entered his mind. He rushed towards me, huge hands out, ready to break me. Chapter 28. Cash faked left, swept to my right and gathered me up in a chokehold, his hairy arm wrenching me backwards. I let him take me, pushed off the ground and rolled over him, shocking him with how fast I had him on his back. We both twisted, righted, kicking red sand. His glasses had been knocked off. He ignored them. My heart swelled with a sick kind of joy. I liked to fight. I've been fighting since I was a kid, trying to claw some corner of existence for myself in houses where I was the cuckoo invading the nest. Cash was eyeing me, trying to decide his next move. I didn't give him time to go on the offensive again. I rushed at him, caught his arm and tried to twist it as we danced in the dirt. He grabbed the back of my neck and shoved me downwards, using my own momentum as I'd used his. I was pinned on my back, the wind knocked out of me. Most people panic when they can't breathe in a fight, but I knew the air would slowly return. I kicked out and he overbalanced, fell on me. I shoved his jaw upwards. Snail was watching us from the truck. I locked eyes with her, my neck and shoulders and arms on fire as the incredible weight of Cash's body came down upon me. She grimaced as Cash leaned on me. It was clear who she was rooting for. I kicked again, got him in the hip. I twisted and scrambled out from beneath him, got him on my own chokehold, a knee in his spine. He stood, and I went with him, absurdly hanging off him like a monkey trying to wrestle a bear. He tried to shake me off, gripping at my arms, but I locked my legs around his waist, and then he did what I hoped he'd do. Cash sank to his knees and fell backwards, trying to crush me against the ground. I slid sideways before I could hit the dirt, let go of his neck and scooped up his arm. I wrenched it high against his back. He yowled, shocked by the sudden pain, and I shoved the back of his head down so that his cheek hit the red earth beneath us. Yes! I stumbled off him, wiping sweat from my eyes. Yes! 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 The giddy exhilaration of my win lifted the weight of the last chance case, of my brother's case, right off my shoulders in an instant. For a second, I felt free. When I fought, I felt strong. I felt that I could take care of myself. I was a warrior. Cash was dusting sand out of his ear when I came back to myself, back to the shitty hole in the desert, the middle of nowhere, far from where I needed to be. My smile faltered, as with painful clarity, a little voice in my head reminded me that though he was clearly an idiot, a stubborn and ignorant being, this man was supposed to be my partner. We were supposed to be working on this thing together. I offered my hand to Cash, but he didn't take it. He gave me a hateful look and walked off towards the car. Chapter 29. Whit turned the page of the psychologist's report before him. Clatter and crash of the prison visitor's centre pushed back in his mind until it was only a dull hum in his ears. Beyond the plexiglass, a door opened at the end of the small corridor. Samuel Blue was shuffled to the chair before the detective. Whit put the psychologist's report in his briefcase and pulled out his notebook and pen. "How are you going, Edward?" Sam gave a tired smile. The two had met in the courtroom briefly the day before, exchanged a phone call. "Oh, you know, how are you? That's the more important question." "I really need that money you were talking about on the phone." Sam leaned forwards so that his mouth was centimetres from the speaker holes in the glass. "I'm hot property in here, and the only thing that's going to keep the other cons off my back is protection money. I've used up the cash Harry gave me." "You still receiving threats?" Whit asked. "Daily. Staff and inmates now." "Jesus." "Yeah," Sam sniffed. "I know the drill. Harry told me. Protection money in prison is a lifetime deal. You pay once, you have to keep paying. But I need to at least keep drip-feeding these guys some cash, or I'm not going to survive to see the rest of the hearings." "I'll move some money into your account this afternoon." Whit made a note. "I don't know how to fight." Sam seemed distracted, rubbing his palms together hard. "I'm a fucking graphic design expert. I haven't been in a scrap since I was a kid. Harry's the fighter." "I spoke to her this morning. She's desperate to get back here." "She should stay as far away as she can." Sam locked eyes with Whit. "I never wanted her here in the first place. Whoever's doing this to me, they'll be after her next. Someone's got to want to see me suffer big time to put this much effort into a frame-up. I'd suffer pretty badly if anything happened to Harry, right?" Whit tapped the side of his page thoughtfully with his pen. He worked through his words before he spoke, tried to keep them diplomatic, supportive. "So you still think someone is framing you?" "It's the only explanation," Sam said. "They went into my apartment. They planted those things. Someone abducted those girls when I was in the same area. They must have been following me." "It's..." Whit cringed. "It's a lot of effort to go to do this to you." "You're telling me, mate? I mean, you have no idea who it is?" "No clue." "How can someone be that angry at you, and you have no idea who they are?" Whit asked. "Whatever you did to them must have been a supreme betrayal to warrant this, something really, really bad." Sam's lips twitched. Whit could see a hidden anger flickering there, pulsing like a heat behind the man's eyes. "You don't believe me?" "I never said that. Because Harry said you were on our side." "I'm on Harry's side." Whit swallowed hard. "And Harry's on your side." "Right." Sam nodded. his jaw ticking with barely contained fury. Well, mate, you're correct. Whoever is framing me has gone to an awful lot of effort. They must hate me really bad. And it would be ridiculous for me to have no idea what it was. Unless, of course, I never knew how angry they were in the first place. Okay, Whit nodded. I see your point. What if it's an ex-girlfriend? Sam shrugged. Someone I broke up with who I thought was okay but who really wasn't. You know, people can get these crazy stalker women. What if all these years she's hated me for leaving her and I never knew it and the hate has just been festering and festering? Whit said. Imagine how many sick and twisted people I might have offended in my ordinary everyday life who I have no idea have harbored this vendetta against me. I've had students over the years who've plagiarized assignments for my classes. They were expelled because I caught them out, because I brought their work to the dean and he cancelled their enrollment. Right. There was a guy. Sam was almost rambling now, his eyes wandering over the scratched surface of the glass between them. Another applicant for the position at the university? Maybe he blames me for not getting that job. Maybe this goes back further than that. Maybe it goes all the way back to when I was a kid moving around in and out of care. What if someone got placed in a family or didn't get placed in a family because of me? Sam. What if? Sam. I think you're winding yourself up now, Whit said, touching the glass where the prisoner's knuckles rested. You're right. If it's a frame-up, it could be anyone. This person is sick. Why they're doing it to you may not be as logical as we're expecting it to be. Sam tapped his wrist on the table before him, making the cuffs clatter rhythmically on its surface. He was panting, on the edge of losing it completely. Whit made notes in his notebook, glancing up now and then at the frightened man's eyes. It was all very convincing, Whit thought. If Sam's distress wasn't real, it sure was a good act. Chapter 30. He didn't even feel the impact. Whit was walking across the darkened car park towards the elevator of his apartment building when suddenly it seemed that the lights went out. He only realized he'd been hit when he tried to move and felt the oily, wet surface of the asphalt beneath his face. He shifted, and the pain in his head made itself known. A huge, thumping ache. Terror sparked through him. He saw blood on the hand by his face, his own hands, numb. Whit tried to rise and a voice stopped him. "Not so fast," a gravelly voice said. "You make yourself yak." Whit slid carefully into a sitting position, propped himself against the wall by the elevator. There was a man leaning against the bonnet of someone's car just meters away, a slice of pizza in one hand and a cardboard pizza box balancing on the flat of his other palm. Unkempt blonde hair, a dusty leather jacket, big boots. Whit took the details in slowly, his mind refusing to come to full consciousness all at once. He did indeed feel like yakking. He felt the back of his skull tentatively with his fingers, noted the blood soaking his hair, his briefcase, wallet, phone, gun. It was all gone. He found his glasses and slipped them on. "Did you do this?" Whit asked. "Ha! No, I'm not a fucking coward. I use my fists." "I was hit with something?" "You've been slocked," the man said. "Congratulations." The man rolled a lump of asphalt he'd been toying with under his enormous black boot across the space between them. It came to a stop near Whit's knee. He picked up the chunk of rock and looked at it, dazed. "Whoever it was that hit you, he was an ex-con." The man took a bite of his pizza, chewed while he talked. "You learn to slock a guy in prison. Back in the day, you'd do it with a padlock in a sock, hence slock. Plenty of locks around prisons, makes a convenient disposable weapon. Take your sock off, load it up, swing it up over and down on the guy's head, dump the lock, put your sock back on.
I see.
You know any ex-cons?
Just current ones. Whit dragged himself to his feet.
I didn't catch your name.
Tox Barnes.
Tox? Whit squinted.
Yep.
I'm Edward Whittaker. You're the reason I'm here. I expected to find you upstairs in your apartment, sipping a Chardonnay or browsing an IKEA catalogue or some shit.
No. Looked in the windows there and saw you face-planted on the garage floor. Who'd have thought?
Whit struggled to comprehend. One minute, he'd been walking from his car to the elevator, dreaming of home, worn out from the day in court, visiting Sam in prison. Now a strange, disheveled man was schooling him on prison fight tactics. Whit dragged himself up. He reached for his phone. Remembered it was gone.
I'm with Harry, Tox said.
Oh. Whit watched the man finish the crust of his pizza, then chuck the empty box on the floor of the garage with a soft whump.
Yep. I'm here to help out with the thing with her brother.
Oh, Whit said again.
So you're on your feet?
Tox looked his new partner up and down.
Let's roll.
Chapter 31. It was a long, awkward ride back into town. Cash in the front seat, me in the back. Snail tried to make light, cheerful conversation to cover the silence. The dog sat staring at me as though my pockets might be full of treats, a long string of drool hanging from her tongue. She started barking as we came into sight of the town.
Oh, shit.
Snail said as we pulled into the main street. At the end of the row of 10 stores, comprising the entirety of the town centre, was the tiny police station. It was crowded with people. The gun-slinging group from the front of the pub had Zach Taby bailed up against the front doors. Digger and I jumped from the car before Snail had time to shut the engine off. The dog ran towards the group, its tail wagging so hard her hindquarters were swaying back and forth. It certainly was a friendly thing. I could see why the town was so attached to it.
"We've had enough," a man had Zach by the front of his T-shirt, pushing him into the glass. "You're going home to pack your shit and then you're out of here."
"Murderer," someone cried. "Terrorist."
"Break it up," I pushed the man aside. "I'll arrest the lot of you if I have to. Back the fuck up."
One of the farmers pointed a gnarled finger at Zach. "He's murdered our police chief. If you let him keep going, him and his kind will kill us all."
"He's dangerous," a woman said. Suddenly the number of people around me had doubled. "We want him out of our town. We know he's behind this."
"You don't know shit, bitch," Zach spat in the dirt.
"Suck my fat
That's enough from you."
I shoved Zach into the police station. He stumbled deliberately against the front counter, clutching his elbow.
"Oh, my arm! Police brutality!"
"You are going to see some brutality in a minute." I frog-marched the boy through the empty station and into the interview room. Zach flopped into the chair, sunk low, so that his head looked straight across the tabletop, his legs spread beneath its surface. Snail and Cash shut the doors on the crowd and followed me into the darkened room, flipping on lights. Cash leaned on the table, taking up most of its space with his huge arms, forcing Zach to back off into his chair.
"You probably deleted all those photos," Cash said, "but they'll be easy enough to get back."
"No shit," Zach said.
"You're in a real mess, boyo. Tell me about those pictures."
"These ones?" Zach took out his phone and swiped through the photos Cash had talked about at the gully. Naked girls. Kids at a party, huffing dope.
"I didn't delete them. I'm not an idiot, dude. I know you can get them back. That's my ex-girlfriend. Those are her tits. You want a closer look?"
He shoved the phone at Cash's face. I took the phone from between them, looked through the pictures. She's 18. I like older women, and they like me. Zach winked in my direction. And for all you know, those bongs are full of green tea. Try to prove otherwise, I fucking dare you. I bet those joints we pulled out of your pockets aren't full of green tea. You came all the way to this shithole to charge me with possession of weed? Zach sneered. What a bunch of pretenders. The picture that concerns us is this one, I said, finding a picture among the collection. The photograph was of a cluttered table in the middle of a dark shed. Tools, wires, buckets of screws and nails. In the background, a rusty gas bottle sitting on a shelf. That's my mate's dad's shed, Zach said lazily. We build shit in there when we're bored. That lump of metal in the middle of the table is a half-built go-kart. You ever built anything that goes bang? I asked. Zach didn't answer. Stared at his fingernails. There was a spate of low-level mischief involving explosives about 2 years ago, Snail sighed from where she stood in the doorway. A student teacher doing his internship came out to Last Chance Valley in the second school term. He was being supervised by one of our teachers, Greg Harvey, but one morning Greg let the intern take the class by himself. The young teacher thought he'd endear himself to the kids. It was a science class. He taught them about different types of explosives. Oh, great, I said. Cash and I looked at each other. It was nothing as complex as what we saw up on the hillside, Snail said. So it sort of slipped my mind until now. He taught them about gunpowder, basically, how to make their own fireworks. So some of the kids got together and made their own mini firecrackers. Bungers, Zach said. You can make them as small as a cigarette, about 2 seconds fuse, chuck them at old ladies. Fucking hilarious. Not you, though. You wouldn't do anything like that. I rolled my eyes. No, not me. How many kids were in that class? I asked. The one about explosives? About 5 of us, Zach smiled, sat giggling to himself. The only sound in the room, as Snail, Cash, and I quietly despaired about the 4 other kids we now had to interview. Cash slapped the table soon enough, shutting Zach up instantly. This is all very hilarious, I'm sure, but the number one suspect as far as the rest of the town is concerned is you, mate, he said. I've worked in villages outside Johannesburg, where suspicion of a serious crime is all it takes to get you dragged into the bush and hung from a tree. I've worked in villages outside Johannesburg, Zach waved his hands, his voice a buffoonish imitation. Dude, you're such a tryhard, you're not impressing anyone. Cash looked like he wanted to leap across the table and strangle the kid, but he met my eye and I shook my head. I was in charge now. If we were going to do any roughhousing of the suspect, it was my call. And if we spent too much time knocking innocent people around, the people of this town would clam up on us. Small towns were full of secrets. And if we became their enemy, they'd hide the killer in their midst just to spite us. Chapter 32 Cash walked out of the interview room, veins beginning to creep up from beneath the skin near his sweaty temples. Snail followed. I went to sit in the chair Cash had vacated and put my feet up on the table. "Is that Tosser your partner?" Zach asked. "At the moment." I took an intake form from beside the recorder and tossed a pen at the kid. "Fill in this form." I would take the paper and compare Zach's handwriting against the diarist's. The kid sighed and began writing. "So that guy's your boyfriend then?" he said eventually. "Certainly not." "I thought that was the whole deal though," he snorted. "When dude and lady cops work together, they get into dangerous situations, have to save each other's lives, then they fuck." "I'm no lady," I told the kid. and you should be less concerned with who's fucking who and more concerned about the townsfolk lynching you the moment they get a chance. The townspeople can blow me. He sat back in his chair. This kid had a real fascination with fellatio. You ask me, it's the old man you lot should be looking at. Who's the old man? The dude. He waved vaguely behind him in a westerly direction. I don't know his name. Us kids just call him the old man. He lives out there in the Never Never. His people and Dez's people had some drama back in the day when Last Chance was first settled. He won't be friendly, join the town, but won't fuck off either. You'll know him when you see him. He's scary and old. Scary and old, I said. Right, I'll make a note of it. Until then, you're going to have to stay low. People around here want your blood. What else is new? Everything around here falls on me. You get used to it. I'm too big for this joint. They won't know who to pin shit on when I bust out of here. You've got plans to leave? End of the term. I can legally leave school, he said. I'm getting out of here, and I'm never coming back. I don't care if I have to work at a McDonald's and sleep under a bridge. You've got to start somewhere, man. Is that what people do? I asked. Take off as soon as they get the chance. No way. He put his arms behind his head. Around here, you take over your family farms or you go to work for the mines and send your money back here. That's the only reason people have kids in this town, because if they don't, their farms will close down. If everybody leaves, the whole town closes down. So anyone who makes plans to go has to keep it secret or people will start calling you a traitor, talking about how you're abandoning the place. It's supposed to be one for all for one, so people keep having kids and their kids take over the farms and then they have kids. It's an endless, meaningless cycle of bullshit. So what happens if you're a kid around here and you don't want to be a farmer? He made a gun with his fingers, put it to his head. Bang. Don't they try going into the cities? How are you going to leave and start again in the big city when you grew up your whole life in a hole in the earth? Got no money, no friends, no family backing you, no work experience. You don't know the city ways. You try to climb out, it just sucks you back in. But you're not going to get sucked back in? No way. He stretched, reached for the ceiling. I've got a plan. Oh, yeah? What's that? None of your business? He settled back in his chair and knitted his fingers over his skinny chest like he was planning on going to sleep. I knew that kind of calm, the emotionless resolve that comes with knowing you've reached rock bottom, that there's no more trouble that you can get into, no expectations, maximum ostracism. I'd been that kind of teenager, wandering around the city at night on my own, spray-painting trains, breaking windows, lighting rubbish bins on fire. It was actually while I was sitting in a holding cell at Maroubra Police Station, listening to the goings-on in the office, that I'd found my calling. An old lady had wandered in, bleeding after being knocked down only a couple of blocks away, her handbag stolen. I'd watched through the bars as two female officers brought her to a chair by one of the desks, tended to her, soothed her, made her a cup of tea. They were like two daughters caring for their frightened, befuddled mother. And the old lady's eyes wandered over their immaculate blue uniforms, their faces with awe and joy. I'd imagine someone looking at me like that one day, like I was their hero. Zach Taibbi needed to decide how he wanted to be looked at. Right now, it was only me looking at him, seeing myself. But I knew what he was in the eyes of the people here. Their runt. The enemy in their midst. You're going to go home and stay there, I said. I shoved the kid's phone back towards him. Play Xbox or something until this whole thing blows over. If I hear or see you around town before I leave, I'll kick your ass." The kid took his phone and gave a dismissive laugh. He didn't know how serious I was. Chapter 33. There was a slender, beautiful Pakistani woman standing in the police station's main room with Snail and Cash when I emerged, shutting Zach in the interview room to cool his heels. Zach's mother. Cash still had his interrogation stance on, arms folded and heads bowed, eyes narrowed as he took in her face, her figure, as though he could see cruel intentions written on her very countenance. I didn't see anything but a worried, tired woman fed up with her son's antics. "Is he in there?" She pointed towards the door as I closed it. "I am going to absolutely nail that kid." I laughed. Her words were much feistier than her appearance. "Your son hasn't done anything wrong, Mrs. Tavey," I said. "Not lately, anyway. Not that we can see." "Yeah, not that anyone can see," she scoffed. "Half the trouble he gets into. I only hear about it 3 weeks later when someone makes some snide remark to me about their dead cat or their burned-out shed. He didn't kill Mr. Campbell, officer, but I can tell you he hasn't been out there collecting funds for charity. I haven't seen him in 3 days. He needs a smack on the behind." "Well, after you've smacked his behind, we'd appreciate it if you locked him up for a couple of days," I said. "Just until everything settles down."
"Where is Mr. Tavey?" Cash said.
"Mr. Tavey doesn't have time to be running around after our little monster." Zach's mother rolled her eyes. "He works remotely for Ector Corp. His hours are strange. He has to be up all night sometimes talking to his divisional partners. He's locked that computer 16 hours a day."
"Ector Corp," Cash nodded.
"Huh. Your son's in a lot of trouble, Mrs. Tavey," I said. "We're going to need you to keep an eye on him. There are people in this town who would just love to get their hands on him." "They'll have to wait till I'm done with him first," she said, marching towards the interview room. Chapter 34. I really think I ought to seek medical attention. Whit touched the back of his skull tenderly as he sat at the bar Tox had taken him to, looking at the blood on his fingertips. Tox put 2 shots of scotch on the counter before them.
"I hate working with people," Tox said. "Don't make me work with a pussy."
Whit drank the scotch greedily. His mouth was dry, his nerves rattled. And this Tox person was doing little to settle his apprehension. Nothing about the man he was sitting beside convinced him that he was, as he said, an active police officer, someone who had worked by Harry's side on a major case. "Harry has been responsible for most of the hard work on Sam's case," Whit said. "In my briefcase, I had a copy of her notes. Whoever hit me might have been someone working for the press, someone looking for fresh story angles on Sam's case."
"I don't think so," Tox grumbled. "I think it was whoever framed Sam, trying to get ahead of our game, trying to know what we know."
"So you think this whole thing is a frame-up too?"
"Yeah."
"But why on earth would someone do this?" Whit shifted closer, intrigued. "Kill 3 innocent girls just to get revenge against Sam?"
"Whoever this is, they were going to kill those girls anyway."
Tox waved a dismissive hand. All 3 girls were the same type, white, young, ambitious brunettes. "No, that was someone's fantasy. It was ritualized. Same kill technique, same dumping ground. Whoever murdered those girls, he's done it before." "That doesn't fit Sam Blue." Whit sipped his scotch. "He's got a record, but none of it's violent or sexual. Petty theft and drug charges in his teens. He's been good as gold for a decade at least."
"Mm-hmm," Tox grumbled. "But Harry's got the violent streak.
so the public will assume Sam's just better at hiding his. The two men watched their drinks.
You ask me, Tok said. We're looking at two possibilities. The killer has decided to pin his crimes on someone, and he's chosen Sam Blue, whether it's for vengeance or whatever the hell. That, or the police investigating the killings have decided they need a patsy, and Sam Blue's it.
The police? Wit scoffed. Now you've lost me.
You know the guys on the task force, Nigel Spader and his team?
No, Wit said. I knew them way back when, in the academy. They're cowboys. I got a bit of a history myself. He glanced at Wit. You'll learn about it soon enough. So I've seen these guys with their claws out. It might be that they came upon Sam by accident. It might be that they've got some beef with Harriet, and her brother naturally made a great suspect. Wit sighed.
What the hell are we going to do to clear this up?
From my understanding, Harry's been working on the girls, checking out their autopsies, the crime scenes, their abductions, trying to look for clues there. I reckon we find out what's happened with this Caitlin McBeal girl, find out what Linny Simpson's final version of events is. Where is Caitlin? Why isn't she answering her phone or accessing her account? It's weird. And the police reaction to it is even weirder. The cops just don't want to admit something's wrong there because it fucks with their Sam Blue theory.
Okay, Wit sat up. He felt tingles of exhilaration rush through him. Hope. Dangerous hope. We can do that. We can find her.
Don't get too excited. Tok sipped his drink. We want to find her alive. We find her dead. And all we've got is more unanswered questions.
Chapter 35. The video camera they found at Sam's. That's weird too, Tox mused.
It is, Wit agreed.
The task force found the camera just sitting there at the end of the bed on a tripod, no files on it, totally blank. And there isn't a single fingerprint on it, or trace of DNA. How does the guy use the thing for a prolonged period of time without leaving a trace of himself on it? It didn't have anyone's prints on it. It had been wiped clean. Why wipe your prints off it if you're just going to leave it sitting in your apartment?
It's a prop, Tok said. It's been planted, for sure. Magazines, too.
And where are the video files? Wit shrugged. Nothing was found on either of Sam's computers at home. Nothing on his work computer. Why take all the time to record your deeds and then destroy the files?
The two men considered the glasses on the countertop some more.
Wit fiddled with the gash in the back of his head. He wasn't sure what would happen now. The man beside him looked tired, ragged, almost bored with the whole thing. But something told Wit that he might be the kind of man who always looked that way, a sleepy old python not easily aroused into showing its fangs. Wit wasn't sure if this man was a police officer or a private investigator. He was itching to call Harriet and check out if he even was who he said he was.
It might be that we're completely wrong about all this, Tok said. Maybe there is evidence to convict Blue. Lack of prints, lack of DNA. It doesn't mean they're not there, it just means the forensics guys haven't found them. Maybe Blue wasn't acting alone, and whoever he was acting with, that's where all the pieces lie. That's how it all fits together.
What makes you think a partner might be involved?
Look, it doesn't make sense that Blue's the killer and he left that evidence in the apartment the way it was, he said. Innocent or guilty, Sam Blue did not leave a setup like that on purpose. No way. Maybe Blue is innocent, and the whole thing has been planted on him by someone. Or maybe Blue is guilty, and he has a partner, and his partner knew the two of them were going to go down. He sacrificed Blue so he could go on killing, make a fresh start. How would he have had time to plant the evidence? Whit asked. Surely Nigel's team went straight to the apartment after arresting Blue on his way to work.
Nah, Tox smirked. They arrested Sam at 11 a.m. They didn't even get into the apartment till 6 that night. Nigel's team. Bunch of excited schoolgirls. Everybody wanted to be in on the Blue interrogation. Only dragged themselves away when they started hitting a wall. Could be someone snuck into Blue's apartment after the arrest, but before the raid, I don't know. Whit thought about the shaven-headed man in court. The image of him suddenly popped into his mind, a flash. He dismissed it. His battered brain playing tricks, speculating. Blue had scratches on him that the team photographed after the interrogation, Tox said. Nigel tried to say they were from the girls trying to fight Blue off, but Blue was in that interrogation room for 22 hours. I reckon he might have copped them in there. No one photographed him at intake. That's dodgy. We've got to figure out what's going on here one way or the other. I guess we're looking at two very interesting possibilities, Whit said. Blue's either completely innocent, or he's a very dangerous psychopath, Tox said. The kind who wears sheep's clothing. Chapter 36. It was midnight. I sat at Snail's kitchen table listening to the sound of Jerry snoring coming from the room nearby. Photographs of Theo Campbell's various remaining body parts had been emailed through to us from the morgue in Orange. Was Theo Campbell's death indeed a part of some grander plan? Were there more bodies to come? Cash had tried to convince me all evening that Adil Tabey, Zach's father, was a worthy avenue we needed to be looking into. Ekdor Corp, the company he worked for, had its hands in oil and gas extraction in the Middle East, and there were rumours of the company's interest in arms dealership. I reminded him that I was in charge. We'd made a deal. Tabey's parents didn't interest me as suspects. I pressed open the diary again and touched the tiny, fluid handwriting, ran my fingers over the printed images of mass shooters glued onto the pages. The handwriting didn't look like Zach Tabey's, but I wasn't an expert on that. The diarist and Zach shared a propensity to push overly hard on the paper, dent the pages, make it difficult to read the words in the left-hand side of every page. The diarist had made a close analysis of the actions of Elliot Rodger, who'd killed 6 people and injured 14 others on a rampage through Isla Vista, California. Rodger had stabbed his 3 housemates, then gone after young women in a sorority house nearby, punishing any women he could find for all the sexual rejection he'd faced in his life. The diarist's commentary was more critical of Rodger's killings than it had been for the other shooters. There was a list of mistakes on the right-hand side of the page, under a map of the killer's route of terror through the city. 1. Most victims random, not personal. 2. Undignified video confessional before shooting. Sounds desperate. 3. High-risk initiation. Could have been caught after stabbing housemates. I made a note to check what sort of counselling services were available in the area, both to teens and adults, and what the levels of depression and suicide were in the region. The diarist seemed particularly interested in leaving a good quality manifesto of their ideas and complaints, their reasons for doing what they were planning to do. They would only plan on doing that if they didn't see themselves being around to talk about those things in the aftermath. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold attacking kids at their high school who had taunted them. Elliot Rodger attacking girls who had rejected him. I googled Sung-hee Cho and watched excerpts of his video manifesto on YouTube. You have vandalized my heart, raped my soul, and tortured my conscience. You forced me into a corner and gave me only one option.
These young men weren't trying to inspire people. Each of them would kill themselves after their attacks. They wanted vengeance. It wasn't terrorism. It was payback. I shifted my papers around, found my phone and looked through Witt's email from earlier in the evening about meeting Tox. A tiny smile played about my lips. My heart had been aching to be home, and now I had a new reason to dream of myself there. The incomprehensible partnership of Witt and Tox. A man who never went anywhere without a personal manicure kit. And a man who I'd seen walk around with blood all over his shirt for 2 straight days. Wherever the two went with the leads I'd given Witt, one of them would meticulously gather the tiny breadcrumbs of every possible scenario, while the other walked ahead of him, kicking down doors and shoving people out of his partner's path. When my phone rang, I expected it to be Witt. But it was a number I didn't recognize. I walked out onto the front porch and sat on the step looking at the stars. "Harry," a voice said. "It's me." My heart twisted in my chest. Chapter 37. The last time I'd seen my mother had been on the street corner outside my apartment in Piemont. Her hands had been wrapped in bandages, and her hair had been a thin burgundy nightmare, a fresh tattoo on her neck. She'd wanted to live with me. I'd had to turn her away. She'd stayed overnight with me before, but I'd awakened to find all my valuables and cash gone and my front door wide open. I didn't know what to say to her at first, now that she was on the phone. I'd tried to contact our mother when Sam was first arrested, but she hadn't responded. I'd wondered if she was dead. There was not a centimetre of the Australian landscape that wasn't saturated with the media coverage of the Georges River killer and his dramatic capture. I looked at the stars and sighed. "Are you there?" "Yes," I said. "How can I help you, Julia?" "I wish you wouldn't call me Julia," she said. "It's bad manners." "Is there something that you need?" "I don't need anything, baby. I'm calling to see how yous are, you and Sam."
"Why don't you take a guess?"
"We're fine," I lied. "Was there something else?" "I tried to go to the courthouse today, but I was too late. They'd shut the doors. I want to visit Sammy, but I'm not on his visitors list. Can you get him to put me on?"
"You're not worried you'll be arrested as soon as you walk in the door?" I asked. "You've still got warrants out."
My mother's crimes of choice were burglary and car theft. She was wanted in 4 states.
"I need to see him."
"Well," I sighed, "you could give it a shot." "I've been crying for days and days," she sniffed. "It's been hard to contact yous both. After I saw the headlines, I was just fucking out of it, you know? I just lost it, mate. I went to bed and I pretty much haven't been up in months." "I can't believe any of this. Any of it. How has this happened?"
"That's what we're all trying to work out."
"Well, I'm ready to do my part now, eh? I'm ready to help you both through this. It's the least I can do." She drew a deep breath, allowing me to prepare myself for the grand show of generosity that was about to come. "But they've asked me to do a spread in her weekly. It's paid. I want to donate some of that money to Sam's legal fees."
I felt heat rush up into my mouth.
"You what?" "Some magazine lady called me. They want to do a 4-page spread on my story. It'll be me and some photos of yous when yous were kids. Some stories about raising you both. I was speechless. They're offering $40,000, she sniffed. So I thought, you know, 5 or 10 grand of that could go to you and Sam. Help out with the lawyer, whatever. You can't do this, I said. I was standing now, my mouth opening and closing, the words failing to come. You just can't, Julia. I mean, what the hell are you going to say? Sam and I, we were practically toddlers when we left your care. Harry, it's not like I didn't have any say in how yous were raised. I always knew where yous were. I called dozens of times. I couldn't breathe. Harry, are you there? Julia, I said, listen to me very carefully. Her weekly isn't interested in how you raised us and what lovely children we were. They're not going to paint this as some beautiful, tragic tale of a misunderstood woman and the perfect little angels who were stolen from her by evil child services. They're going to represent you as an irresponsible junkie and the two of us as institution rats with violent backgrounds. No, they're not. Yes, they are. I gave an angry laugh. Anything else would be a lie. She was silent. In the background of the call, I could hear a television playing, a man shouting, Julia, they're going to sit you down and wave money in your face and get you to confide in all the awful stuff you've done over the years, and then they're going to use that as evidence to suggest Sam is guilty. Harry, my life is really hard right now. I don't expect you to understand. You being a fucking copper and all. You've been trained to hate people like me. Okay, I said, I'm hanging up now. I need that money, Harry. I'm going to use it to start again. I've met someone. We're going to start a business together. This is the one, Harry. I can feel it. He's not like the others. I didn't say anything. I have always loved you, Harriet. She gave a sharp, furious sigh. I've always loved your brother. Doesn't that count for anything? Jesus Christ, I don't know how you ended up such an ungrateful bitch. I'm doing my fucking best here. I hung up. Gripped my hair. I wanted to howl into the night. It was like my brother was sinking in quicksand. Every time I thought someone was coming along to help me free him, they only kicked more sand at him. The more he struggled, the deeper he got. I knew if too many people joined the crowd trying to bury him, I'd never get Sam out alive. Chapter 38. In the morning, we paid a visit to Theo Campbell's friend David Lewis to see what he thought about the former police chief's death. The younger man had seen Theo that afternoon, climbing the roof of his little farmhouse with him, and accepted his help in fixing some broken tiles. Lewis had, of course, heard the news already and seemed bewildered. The last person to see the victim before a tragedy is often haunted by what has happened. David repeated words I'd heard often, that Theo had seemed fine, that he couldn't believe he watched his friend walk off so casually to what would be such a violent death. The sun was high and blazing as we pulled into the Campbell driveway. Olivia Campbell opened the door to us, her hands red from wringing and her eyes puffy. She had the reserved dignity of a cop's wife, her outfit put together and her hair neatly pulled into a tight bun. A woman who carried on in the face of adversity, at least in terms of appearance. Someone who never let the cracks show. There was a framed wedding photograph of the two of them just inside the door. Theo was broad-shouldered, tall and bushy-browed. I went to the doors that looked out onto the backyard, watched the family cat as it toyed with a dead locust by the edge of the lawn. "It's drugs," Olivia said as she and Snail settled on the lounges. "People are saying it's terrorism or it's related to the diary they found, but I'm telling you, it's some drug gang that's got him." Snail and I exchanged glances, shocked. I didn't know what I'd expected. Some small talk about Theo, about how Olivia was coping, but she launched straight in. Cash looked skeptical. He stood at the bookcase, looked over the tattered paperbacks there. He zeroed in on a copy of the Quran like a hawk and seized it from the third shelf, as though he'd find the answer to Theo's demise there. "What do you mean, drugs?" Snail asked gently. "We're on top of the drug situation in the region. We don't have any gangs out here." "Theo said he was running an undercover sting," Olivia explained. "See, we went to bed one night, maybe a month ago, and I woke up at around midnight, and Theo wasn't beside me. I went to the front windows and looked out. I saw him talking to Jace Robert and his crew. I asked him what was going on when he came back inside. He wouldn't tell me much about it. He said he thought there was drug activity going on. Ice production." Snail shook her head ruefully, disbelieving. I came and settled on the edge of the couch. "There is ice around here," Snail told me. "Softer drugs too, lots of weed. But any amphetamines are mostly brought through by the truckers heading to Bourke, about 4 hours out. Bigger town. People buy it at one of the local pubs there, we think, to keep themselves running until the next round comes through." "It's only small amounts?" "The kids use it recreationally. They're bored. There's nothing to do out here. We'd know if anyone in town was manufacturing it. Something like that would be difficult to hide, and there'd be no point in making it. You wouldn't be able to sell huge amounts of it out here. Ice is made in the cities, where you've got a chance of blending in." I remembered the wonky-toothed, narrow-bodied man with the rifle, Jace. His little gathering of similarly sun-worn types. "Robert has a cattle property on the south side of the valley," Snail pointed. "Was Theo sure it was drugs they were manufacturing?" Cash asked Olivia, who looked up, red-eyed. "Or was he just suspicious?"
"I don't know." Olivia wiped her nose on a well-used tissue. "I only saw them that one night, and I didn't ask for any more details. I remember them all standing out there on the road, and the headlights were all on. The forensic officers, they told me that whoever killed Theo had been pacing around near him, had tied him to a chair." She fought back tears. "Maybe it was some sort of interrogation, see whether he'd told anyone else." I wandered into the office while Snail comforted Olivia. This was obviously Theo's domain. There was a cracked leather desk chair and an old dusty laptop, a collection of brass nautical navigation equipment on the desk in desperate need of a polish, more books. I went in and sat on Theo's chair, looked out the window onto the bare lawn. There were papers on his desk, a half-finished memoir of a rural police chief's life. Zach Taby had said that diaries were for little girls, but Theo Campbell had spent hours upon hours reflecting on his long career, setting down his personal history in these pages. I flipped through and caught the occasional word. Honour. Evidence. Tragedy. Arrest. "He would have told Snail about an undercover operation," Cash whispered from the doorway. He was still holding the Quran like a much-loved teddy. I watched him go to the bookshelves here.
"I agree,"
I said. If farmers were making ice out here, there'd be no need to run an undercover sting. Just go raid their properties. Ice manufacture is expensive, complicated, and it reeks. How on earth would they hide the smell?